From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kim Gordon co-founded the band Sonic Youth with Thurston Moore. When their marriage broke up in 2011, so did the band.
I really hated my life at that point.
Today, Gordon talks about her memoir, Girl in a Band. Also, we talk with Katja Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, the husband and wife team who created the web series High Maintenance. Sinclair also stars in the series as a pot dealer.
I came here with 9 bags, and now I only have 7. So you either give me back the one you took, or you give me another $50.
Well, I took one from you, which I literally just paid you for.
Later, Ken Tucker reviews singer-songwriter Nora Jane Struthers' new album, and David Bianculli reviews 2 shows, ABC's American Crime, created by John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay for 12 Years a Slave, and the new Netflix comedy, co-created by Tina Fey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When 2 members of a band are married, what happens if the marriage ends? The band Sonic Youth had to break up after the marriage of founding members Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon broke apart in 2011. The band and the couple had been together nearly 30 years. In the process of figuring out her new life, Kim Gordon has written a memoir called Girl in a Band. Sonic Youth never developed a mainstream following, but it was a powerful influence on many indie bands, with its emphasis on noise and distortion and its roots in punk and the avant-garde. Gordon played bass, wrote lyrics, and sang. Gordon and Moore each now have their own bands. Hers is called Body Head. Gordon's memoir opens with her description of Sonic Youth's final concert at a festival in Brazil shortly after she'd learned that Moore was cheating on her with a younger woman. Sonic Youth opened their set with this song, Brave Men Run. Here's their original recording of the song. Gordon wrote the lyrics and sings. Kim Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Do you feel like you're having to reinvent your life now that your marriage and Sonic Youth are over?
I don't know. I don't really think about it that way, but I guess I feel like, I had to rediscover my identity or reclaim who I feel like I am. You know, my identity was so much wrapped up with the band and, of course, my husband and that relationship. So, yeah, once that fell apart, it was kind of like, who am I and how did I get here?
Is that a hard question to be asking yourself at 61? And is there an upside to asking that to yourself at 61?
It's a hard question, but I think that it's something that I feel like I've always been in a certain process of discovery my whole life of who I am. And I feel like I was somewhat, you know, stuck in my marriage and in my life. So in a way, I see it as kind of only a positive thing at this point.
So let's talk about how you started to play music. Let me quote something from your memoir. Guys playing music. I love music. I wanted to push up close to whatever it was men felt when they were on stage together, to try to link to that invisible thing. It wasn't sexual, but it wasn't unsexual either. I joined a band so I could be inside that male dynamic. Did you feel that dynamic? Did you feel that power when you started to be on stage yourself in Sonic Youth?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a certain actually thrill of electricity itself, and plugging a guitar into an amp and playing electric guitar is a very visceral, physical thing. Like your movements can affect the sound of the guitar, and I related to that in a way that, because I always like to do dance, I kind of related to that on a certain level that I hadn't expected. And I did feel, there were times, yeah, when it felt really great to be just surrounded by the sound and music, and kind of just in a thrilling way of not knowing what was going to happen.
So in talking about that kind of male energy and male dynamic on stage, when a band of men is on stage performing, do you feel like you changed that dynamic being a woman in where the rest of the members of the band were men, and also being a couple, because you and Thurston Moore were a couple and then you were married, so that maybe changes that energy, that dynamic too?
Yeah, I think I always tried to maintain my individuality in the band, and I didn't actually want to be seen as a couple. In fact, it wasn't until I was writing this tour diary for the Village Voice that my editor said, you have to say that you're a couple. And, you know, I just wanted to be really seen on my own terms.
So did people not know until that point?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, some people did, but I think...
What year are we talking that you wrote that?
Maybe like 84, 85. I don't know, 85 maybe. Yeah, maybe 85.
So, you know, just when we're thinking about the energy on stage, how did that energy change during the final tour when you were in South America, when you knew that your marriage was over, but you still had a commitment to do this final tour? And, you know, you don't want to act that out on stage, you know, the acrimonious separation. So what can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
Well, it was very surreal because... you're playing before these huge audiences, and obviously not everyone was there to see Sonic Youth. We were playing with huge rock bands, and we were probably the smallest act on the bill, but it was odd to know that everybody knew that we had broken up and that this might be the last show. So it was hard to, it felt ridiculous in a way to pretend like everything was normal. It was hard.
You've always loved music, but you didn't know how to play. And you write, you've never considered yourself a musician. So what inspired you to actually start playing?
It began with, this artist friend of mine, Dan Graham, who had a performance piece, and he wanted to do the piece with an all-girl band. So he asked me if I wanted to participate, and that was kind of how it started. But, you know, the whole atmosphere of this was like post-punk era, in a sense, 1981. But something about punk rock, I was just talking with someone about this, how it kind of set people off on this course and you didn't know where it was going. And it wasn't about being a musician. It was just kind of this almost social phenomena that was happening, but it was happening through music. Whereas everything had been fairly staid in mainstream music and also the culture. And so it kind of almost like set up this context where anyone could kind of participate. So it was this whole other avenue that was opened up, and it kind of pulled you along with it.
Do you have a lot more technique now than you did then?
I suppose I do, but it's hard to describe. Like, I have a vocabulary of sound, and, you know, I have a pretty good sense of space and rhythm, but... you know, again, it's now I play mostly improv music, and You know, it's not really about playing conventional chords. And it never was in Sonic Youth. It was, the guitars were always tuned in different tunings. The bass was tuned in regular, a regular tuning. So we didn't really talk in terms of chords so much. And, I almost felt like I had to work against learning how to play, because there was kind of a skill in that, really.
So it was like noise and drone, not only aesthetically appealing to you, but, you know, easier to play for you.
Sure. Well, it was more conducive to what I, to who I was. Like, I, you know, coming out of the art world, and I wasn't, had no interest in learning how to play conventional music. That wasn't really, you know, when I moved to New York, I was really influenced by no wave bands, who were incredibly free, and bands like DNA and Mars and The Static and Rhys Chatham. You know, there was a, it was different than conventional three chord punk rock.
Let me quote you again. You write, for high-end music labels, the music matters, but a lot comes down to how the girl looks. The girl anchors the stage, sucks in the male gaze. So did you become aware of that in a new way when you signed with a major label? And did you feel like you had to dress not only in a more mainstream or fashionable way, but in a more sexualized way?
I mean, it wasn't anything that I was pressured into. I was just super aware of the platform being bigger, and that was, I was kind of into playing around with that idea and how clothes absolutely change the way people look at you. It was more like, you know, experimenting with it. It wasn't like they wanted me to do that. I was just pretty aware of it.
So what are some of the looks you tried, and how did you feel different with each of those when you were performing?
Well, I'd sort of worked my way out of the giant large T-shirt with choker and boots, which was actually, you know, T-shirts were such a big part of indie rock, and I finally discovered how to make it into a dress. And then, you know, I started wearing, like, shorts on stage, or, you know, like, silver leather hot pants, or, you know, things that I could buy from Patricia Field's store, who dressed all the transvestites pretty much downtown. You know, somehow I got a lot of energy from having bare legs on stage.
So just compare for me what it was like getting dressed for a concert, for a performance, comparing how much time you had to spend getting dressed and thinking about what you were going to wear and what your image was going to be, compared to your husband, Thurston Moore's time spent getting dressed and thinking about how he was going to look on stage.
Well, you know, usually I guess I'd figure out for a whole tour what I was going to wear. And it was usually like, would boil down to one thing or two things that you just, you know, become like part of your skin and you feel comfortable in. And then you just then don't have to think about it every night. And then you're always like having to change often in some like horrible bathroom or someplace. Basically, you know, the guys were just pretty much wear, or, you know, Lee would probably change his shirt or something. But, you know, it's kind of like, they would sweat in their clothes. And I saw it as almost a practical thing. Like, I'm just wearing this every night, and I'm not going to, like, get my other clothes sweaty. And I had this one dress I wore on this tour we did in 1991, this striped dress that would get so sweaty, and it would shrink every show, so it kept getting shorter and shorter. But it was kind of, it's kind of cool, actually, if you do find one thing that you just wear. You know, like, I always remember, like, seeing Keith Richards wearing you know, the same like fur vest or, you know, some thing. That to me is like really rock, when you just wear one thing. And then I suppose that comes out of being a junkie, but I don't know. It kind of like establishes a certain rock look, you know, like you're...
You're not referring to yourself here.
No, I'm not referring to myself. I'm just saying that that whole aspect of like looking cool because you're just wearing the same thing every day, you know?
Yes, because you don't care.
or it's not like you're putting on a persona at night. You know, it's kind of like, it's not show busy, which has kind of changed in music over the years.
Oh, God, things are so show busy now. I'm just sometimes shocked at how show busy, like, not just the rock world, but the pop world and the hip hop world. You know, it's
like Las Vegas.
It's like Vegas, exactly. And then there's all the kind of S&M fetish wear that so many women wear in performances. What do you think of that?
I mean, I think it's a
look.
That's a look. There are a lot of ways to be sexy. Like it's like wearing, you know, your sexuality on your sleeve for sure, or your sleeve, if you had a sleeve. I find I'm more into more subtle sexuality. I remember when we played in Detroit once, this kind of experimental noise band opened up called Universal Indians. And there was two guys and a girl, and she was wearing... you know, sort of baggy, like 517 Levi cords, which my friend and I used to wear all the time. And so she looked kind of tomboyish, and then she was playing her guitar with a rock. And I just thought, well, that's a cool move. That's really sexy. So, you know, everyone has their own idea of what is sexy, I guess.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kim Gordon, a founding member of the band Sonic Youth, and now the author of a memoir called Girl in a Band. Sonic Youth broke up when she and her husband Thurston Moore, who is also a founding member of the band, broke up. And Kim, you write about this some in your book. You found out that he was cheating with a much younger woman, and he lied to you about it. And when you decided to leave him and end the marriage, you also, I'm sure, knew that that would break up the band. Did you have to weigh at all what it would mean to not only end your marriage, but to also break up the band, which was not only like your art, it was your source of income. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, the father of your daughter's source of income, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I didn't feel like I had any choice. I mean, I did everything I actually could to, you know, maybe much longer than I should have, tried to hang in there and, you know, see what would happen. But it just, you know, just didn't really, didn't work. I hated my life at that point.
How did the band react to the end?
I think everyone was just shocked, basically, by who the person was, and, you know, it was somebody we all knew. And I mean, I talked to Lee and Steve individually, but we didn't really talk a lot about what it meant in terms of the band. Like, I think everyone was kind of processing it and still processing it. You know, it's something that takes a long time to get over, like any relationship.
Well, you have a new band now called Body Head, and there's a lot of noise and dissonance in it. And you're right, noise and dissonance can be an incredibly cleansing thing. Is it as cleansing now in your 60s as it was in your 20s and 30s?
I don't know. It's kind of, I mean, the music that Bill and I make in Body Head, it sometimes is kind of relaxing. I don't know, my friend who came to see us was like, She felt like it was a little trance-inducing, and it's really, I mean, when you're doing something that's so much fun to do and challenging, it gives you so much that, I don't know if cleansing is the word, but it's just sort of making new memories.
Kim Gordon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kim Gordon co-founded the band Sonic Youth and is the author of the new memoir, Girl in a Band. After a break, we'll hear from the creators of the web TV series High Maintenance about a pot dealer and his clients. David Bianculli will review two short shows he considers part of the new TV revolution, an ABC series created by John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay for 12 Years a Slave, and a Netflix comedy co-created by Tina Fey. And Ken Tucker will review a new album by songwriter Nora Jane Struthers. That's after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Nora Jane Struthers is a singer-songwriter who grew up in New Jersey and was teaching high school English in Brooklyn before moving to Nashville to attempt a full-time career in music. With her band The Party Line, she's just released a new album called Wake. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I used to let this body carry me around. I saw my own reflection in the gazes I felt.
Nora Jane Struthers sings in a clear, unadorned manner. It suits the direct lyrics that fill up her new album, Wake. Given the content of the songs, the title seems in part to refer to an awakening Struthers has had about who she is, what she wants to do, and how she wants to sound. Struthers uses this album to tell some autobiographical stories. They tend to be terse and quietly witty. In this, Nora Jane lives up to being named after Nora Charles in Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man and Jane Austen. In the song called The South, Struthers traces her journey from New Jersey to Nashville, proclaiming the South as the place where she feels most at ease. All of this set to a spare, gentle melody.
I was born in Virginia. I live in Tennessee. Grandma came from Carolina. I was raised in New Jersey. It's just something about the air down here. It's much easier to breathe. Not damn sure ain't ashamed of where I come from. But I ain't never gonna leave.
A visit to YouTube brought earlier videos of Struthers singing straight folk music and bluegrass, influences that are consigned to the outer edges of this album. Although the instrumentation is country, there's a rock and roll force and forthrightness on many of the songs here, such as an anthem of self-definition called Let Go.
I wrote it down when I was 14, not to slouch, just to seem like I was shorter than the boys. And I started carving out the weak parts. Till I was a woman, I became by choice. And now I'm looking at you, picking out a record, trying to find what you think I like. And it don't come naturally, but you're giving me reason to try.
That song, Let Go, is about the roles women play throughout their lives to fulfill certain expectations. Struthers is pushing back against that. You wouldn't expect anything less from a rock and roller. But Struthers is as prey as any of us are to the way that falling in love can make you dependent, happily, hungrily dependent, on the person you're in love with. Which is why another song here, Lovin' You, is in some ways even more of a test of feminist principles than Let Go. In an interview, she referred to this state of mind as strength through vulnerability. And Lovin' You expresses that with even more emphasis.
I got a lot of things inside of my heart. Before we were together, they were pushing me apart. Love is such a mystery, I just don't understand. Who I was before you were my man.
Although she's based in Nashville and her band The Party Line deploys banjo and fiddle and sometimes imports a pedal steel guitar, no one is going to hear the material on Wake as pure country music. It's singer-songwriter stuff in confessional mode. But it's rare for her to slip into mere self-absorption. Struthers always sounds alert to what's going on around her, who she's surrounded by. And she forms brisk opinions about all of this.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Wake, the new album from Nora Jane Struthers. This is Fresh Air. There are more and more ways for the creators of TV shows to bypass the TV networks, like creating web series. The web series High Maintenance was named Best Web Series of 2014 by LA Weekly. High Maintenance was co-created by our guests, Katja Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, in 2012. Sinclair stars as a pot dealer, known only as The Guy, who rides his bike around Brooklyn, delivering to an assortment of clients. But it's not a stoner comedy. Each episode, which ranges from around 5 to 20 minutes, is more like a funny and sometimes poignant character study of the clients and why they get high. Blickfeld and Sinclair, who are married, use their own money to create the series and shot on location in the apartments of friends as well as in their own apartment. The early episodes of High Maintenance are available free, but last year, the video-sharing website Vimeo made High Maintenance its first original series, which means they started funding the series and charging a small fee for the episodes. Katja Blickfeld is an Emmy Award-winning casting director who worked on the TV show 30 Rock. Ben Sinclair is an actor and editor. Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado spoke to Blickfeld and Sinclair. They started with a clip from an early episode of the series. The episode starts with a couple making dinner when they realize a mouse is caught in a glue trap in their kitchen. They freak out, order some pot from their guy, and when he arrives, they're still obsessing about the mouse.
We're so stressed out. There's a mouse.
Oh, well, just set a trap, guys.
That's the problem. There is a trap, and it's a glue trap, and the mouse is stuck in it, and it's screaming, and it's very clearly suffering, and we don't know what to do.
You just kill it.
No, it's inhumane.
Well, it's not actually inhumane. I mean, we caught a mouse in a glue trap, and we didn't see it till a couple hours later, and then it chewed its leg off like James Franco in that rock climbing movie, and it dragged itself off and expired in the dog dish, so it's like, it might be more humane to kill it.
No, this is not an apartment where things die. This is an apartment where things live. We do not torture in this apartment, and we do not kill.
I mean, to be fair, we already gassed it, and it's, like, totally covered in Pam.
That sounds like torture.
Yeah, I mean, it's doused in Pam, so I think maybe we should just kill it.
Okay, fine.
Will you do it?
Yes, I will do it.
That's a scene from the series High Maintenance. Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, welcome to Fresh Air.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Why were you interested in making the series about a pot dealer? What access did you feel like the pot dealer offered you into characters?
It's really just that the pot dealer can get inside of somebody's apartment and then kind of engage in this activity that's illegal that both him and the client are complicit in. There's kind of this, slightly sexy thing, but it's also short enough, 5 minutes, that you can have like a whole deal in under, 5 minutes time.
You're able to build so much character in the short amount of time. Do you focus on the small details or does the storytelling just kind of happen? I'm thinking about there are just such great details in a lot of the apartments. And I'm thinking particularly of the episode Helen, mm-hmm. which is about an adult son who lives in an apartment with his sick mother. You sort of see the kind of artwork that they have in the house or the piles of stuff. Just feels very much like a New York apartment. And then he gets these packages coming into the house, and then you realize he's trying on different shirts because he has a crush on the dealer and he just wants to look nice. And it's just so many of the episodes are really funny. So many of them are sweet. And this is this one that's super bittersweet. Could you talk about those details that seem to just like say so much about the characters?
That was one of those instances where we kind of cast the apartment and thought to ourselves, we have access to this place and it's so uniquely tiny. How can we make it look even more claustrophobic and small, and who would live there? And I think really that's where the idea came from, was having the space first. And then, of course, we art directed it. I mean, we pulled everything out from the walls to make it look a little smaller. We dug out some things from some thrift shops and we made some fake art and, stuff like that. I mean, we definitely made it look a lot worse than it usually does. But, yeah, that was an instance where the apartment came first.
I want to ask a little bit about casting. Everyone in the series is so great. And mostly it's people I haven't seen before. There are a couple of people I recognize from other shows. For example, Greta Lee, a comedic actress, is in one of the first episodes. She's been on The Amy Schumer Show and The New Girl in other movies. But other than that, I didn't recognize a lot of people. Can you talk about casting the series?
Well, Katya is a casting director. Mm-hmm. That was her entree into the entertainment industry. And she had been meeting actors while casting 30 Rock and other shows for about a decade. But we don't have a traditional audition process, but the thing that could be equated with that is just us hanging out with the person that we'd like to write for. I mean, that's what happened with Dan Stevens. We basically hung out with him a half dozen times before we realized what character would fit best for him.
Let's talk about that episode. Dan Stevens, the British actor who a lot of people would know from playing Matthew on Downton Abbey, he's in one of the episodes, and it's actually the episode Rachel, which you guys just won Writers Guild of America Award for, and congratulations on that.
Thank you. Could
you describe the episode for us a little bit?
Sure. It's about a man named Colin who is a stay-at-home dad. He's a writer. He's a screenwriter, and we allude to the fact he's won an Emmy recently, and now he's in this place where he is stuck. He's got writer's block. He's procrastinating. His wife is working very hard every day. She works for a clothing designer named Rachel Comey, and the wife is the breadwinner, and she is getting increasingly frustrated with her husband, who she realizes is procrastinating. She doesn't know the extent of his procrastination, but the viewer learns that he is just basically sitting around smoking weed all day and trying on dresses and basically cross-dressing in the privacy of his home. And then
he orders weed from the guy and has a long talk with the guy while wearing a dress, which is kind of nerve-wracking for him, but the guy doesn't seem to mind at all.
Well, let's listen to part of that episode, Rachel. In this scene, the client, played by Dan Stevens, has ordered some pot from the guy, and he's let him in, and he's wearing a dress.
Yeah, man. This was a good little read. Thank you so much.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's good, isn't it? It's a lot of some good stories in it. I'm glad you liked it.
I mean, I was like, why isn't this guy calling me? I have so many good stories about clients, man. Crazy people.
I bet you do.
Yeah. Okay. Look, man. You're wearing a dress right now. I can't pretend that you're not wearing a dress. You don't usually wear dresses. But you look good.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have another customer who cross-dresses.
Oh, you do?
Very frumpy.
Yeah, the taste in the community can be a bit patchy, you know?
Yeah, his taste sucks. Your taste is... It works, man. I'm like, where's my dress?
Yes. It's Rachel Comey.
That's a scene from the episode Rachel, and that's also the episode that Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair won the Writers Guild of America Award for. Now, Katya, you were in casting for a long time. You were a casting director for the show 30 Rock, and you even won an Emmy for that. 30 Rock is such a great show, and it had this great cast, and it also had guest stars over the seasons, you know, Elaine Stritch, yes. Elizabeth Banks, John Hamm. So what does a casting director do, or what did you do as a casting director on that show? Did you have to sort of work on all of those levels?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I was part of a team. It wasn't just me. But our day-to-day in the casting department was, and this is really what took the most work, I think, was filling all of those sort of lesser roles, those one-scene roles, or those under-fives, as we call them in the business. And those were actually, in my experience, even harder to cast, because it's so much easier to present a role that is several scenes, a juicy role to an actor, and especially on a show like that, and get kind of your pick of whoever you want. But when it comes to sort of those smaller roles, there was this standard in place for really great acting and really great comedy, and you couldn't just sort of throw any old person in a scene with Alec Baldwin, even if it is just one line, even if there's no lines. So it really was challenging, I think, week after week to try to find people who would be humble enough to come and just say a line or two, but also fit the role and could sort of hold their own against people like Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, Jane Krakowski, and sometimes one of those major guest stars.
I want to play a quick clip from 30 Rock, and this episode, it was the 100th episode. Actually, Ben Sinclair, you're in this episode.
Yeah, Ben's in that one.
You're playing the role of Brooklyn Hipster, and just to give a little background on the scene, for some reason, Tracy Jordan, the character Tracy Jordan, played by Tracy Morgan, is sort of freaking out, or maybe he won an Oscar, and he's trying to get back his dirty image, so he's in the street kind of freaking out, and your character, Ben, the Brooklyn Hipster, reacts to it. Let's take a listen.
I am a Jedi!
Hey, look. Tracy Jordan is ironically reappropriating his bad past behavior as a commentary on Fitzgerald's dictum that there are no second acts in American life. I want to take a picture of him with my old-fashioned camera.
No!
And then he falls in the river. Someone falls in the river. Ben, that's you in 30 Rock. I wanted to ask you, I would think that being an actor in New York City would be so difficult. I was looking at your IMDb profile, and I saw that you were in an episode of Law & Order SVU, and I kind of feel like every actor in New York has to make an appearance in one of the Law & Order spinoffs.
It is a rite of passage. Yes.
So I just think that must be hard.
It was hard, and I didn't get any parts until I met Katya, and she was like, why don't you just let your beard grow?
And act like yourself.
There's like a headshot of me where I'm wearing like a members only leather jacket, and I look like real serious, and I am shaven, and my head is shaved, and I look like
like he's trying to be like a tough guy, leading guy,
which is total crap, because like I am like a guy who is like very not tough at all. I've never been in a physical altercation in my whole life, so it was interesting for me to stop caring about trying to be this person I wasn't and just letting that laid-back guy who likes to sit around and smoke pot, to be honest. And that chill guy was able to come out with the beard, but Katya was the one who noticed that I was much better at being this relaxed, open dude who could really talk to anyone. And that's what she says one of her reasons for making High Maintenance was to kind of show that other side of my acting ability.
Well, Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair created the web series High Maintenance, which Sinclair stars in. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. This week, ABC presents American Crime, a new drama series from John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay for the movie 12 Years a Slave. Also this week, Netflix presents The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a new comedy series from Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who collaborated on NBC's 30 Rock. According to our TV critic David Bianculli, they're both part of the new TV revolution, and they're both good.
You can thank the heated competition between broadcast networks and TV's alternative delivery systems, cable, streaming sites, whatever, for the existence and the quality of two of this week's new TV shows. Netflix wants to keep grabbing headlines, so it asks Tina Fey, creator of 30 Rock, what she'd like to do next. ABC, meanwhile, wants to compete with the complexity of cable and streaming shows, widen its audience base and its on-air minority representation, and also gain a little prestige. So it goes to John Ridley, the Oscar-winning screenwriter of 12 Years a Slave, and asks him what he'd like to do next. So presto. This week, viewers can enjoy a new quirky comedy in the 30 Rock mold, and an emotionally raw and captivating new drama that breaks the mold. Let's start with the comedy. The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which releases all of its first season Friday on Netflix, comes from Tina Fey and her 30 Rock cohort, Robert Carlock. It's a comedy about a wide-eyed young woman, one of several held underground for more than a decade by a crazy cult leader. She emerges from her underground bunker and decides to make it on her own in New York City. Ellie Kemper, who played Erin on NBC's The Office, has the title role, and her co-stars include Carol Kane from Taxi and Jane Krakowski and Titus Burgess from 30 Rock. At first, things go charmingly for the perennially perky Kimmy in this strange new world. Until they don't. In this scene, she returns to her new roommate, played by Burgess, and is anything but perky. But, like this new series, she is funny.
They stole my backpack!
What?
I can't do this. Reverend Richard was right.
Wait, who?
Reverend Richard Wayne Gary Wayne, senior prophet and CFO of Savior Rick's Spooky Church of the Scary Apocalypse.
Fool!
I am one of the Indiana Mole women.
From the news. Why didn't you tell me?
Because I just want to be a normal person, and I can't. I don't know anything. I can't tell phones from cameras. Even policemen have tattoos.
Thursday night on ABC, the new drama American Crime premieres, with a concept that paradoxically is simple and complex at the same time. It looks at one crime, the murder of a married man and the near murder of his wife, and follows and dramatizes all the connecting threads of that single case. We meet the grieving parents, the accused killer, and many others tangled somehow into this story's cleverly constructed web. Along the way, we visit and examine several different class structures, ethnicities, and problems. And the longer we watch, the more we're surprised. In TV terms, American Crime is closest to HBO's The Wire or the original miniseries version of Traffic. But it's got a tone and structure all its own. The acting in American Crime is as good as the writing, and I expect this series to muscle into several Emmy categories next year. Benito Martinez from Netflix's House of Cards is commandingly sympathetic as the proud father of a baby-faced teen who may be less innocent than he appears. Caitlin Gerard and Carter Nix are street-level meth addicts who seem sweeter than their harsh environment, until they don't. And at the core of the series are the long-divorced parents of the murder victim, who reconnect only after the husband identifies his child in the morgue. The parents are played by Timothy Hutton and Felicity Huffman. And as they reunite to discuss their dead son's case and what to do about their surviving son, the tensions are painfully palpable.
I couldn't hardly recognize him. The detective said that the gun must have been right in front of his face.
What are the police doing?
Well, they have a description of a car.
When was Matt killed? Sunday? It's Tuesday. That all they have is a description of a car?
They said that they think it might be an Hispanic kid.
Some illegal?
Just Hispanic.
Why did they call you?
And they said that they think that maybe Gwen was raped.
I don't understand why they called you.
I'm his father.
No, I don't understand why they called you first.
You know, they just, they found my number and they called me.
What about Mark?
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, talk to you first.
Oh, you haven't called Mark yet?
No,
oh,
I my thought God, we should call him together.
I'll call him.
He's my son, too.
I'll call him.
We need to be a family now. For both our boys right now, we need to be a family.
Hutton does his best work in years here, and Huffman is magnificent. Hers is a fearless, flawless performance. And because of the way their scenes are written and photographed, as well as performed, American Crime is an important, compelling new series. It's bound to spark a lot of discussion, and it deserves to.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be Larry David, the creator and star of Curb Your Enthusiasm and co-creator of Seinfeld. He has a new play on Broadway, which he wrote and reluctantly stars in. So who did he intend to cast in the lead?
Anyone in particular. Anyone, except me.
So join us for an interview with Larry David tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.